Welcome, welcome, my friends, to the Beggars and Brawlies podcast. This is episode 69, recorded Sunday, the 26th of November, 2023. It's been a while, but I am back with a series of previews for our forthcoming book, Queen of Blood and Blasphemy. And like usual with our preview series, we'll have a little bit of talk afterwards about something, some kind of behind-the-scenes content for the book. This time around, it's the lessons I learned in writing four books and actually finishing a series, which, despite having other series, is the first time I've actually done it. Okay, so before we get into it, just a quick warning that this book, as the other books, especially books 3 and this book 4, are full of spoilers from page 1. So if you haven't read Rebel of Riddle and Woe, which is book 3, or the books that came before it, and you don't want to get spoiled, stop right here, go read those, and come back. At the very least, you could go back and listen to the previous preview series that we've done in this podcast. But you also really won't understand this book if you haven't read the previous ones. And I'm told by the early readers that if you have read them, this one ties it up really nicely. So that is your warning. You are about to get spoiled if you're not already one of my spoiled readers. So here it is, chapter 1 of Queen of Blood and Blasphemy. One. The sea is dark today. I lean against the iron rail of the Dale Clipper, feeling its strange craftology thrum beneath the hull, and watch the gray headlands pass. I have always found comfort in the waters, in the sharp scent of brine and constant slosh of waves, but this morning I see only a reflection of my own thoughts, choppy, disturbed, opaque. In my hands, I clutch a worn roll of parchment, slack with the damp in the air, as my father must have held it, and as I know Hiana once did. And only in that last moment, choking and dying, did I see. All the wisdom I had gained was but lies, and those lies pointed to a deeper truth. A line from entry 213 of the Chronicles, the one that seemed like nonsense because my father recorded it in code. We deciphered it our first day out of Cerrante, using my name as the key, and have been reading it ever since. Not to puzzle out its meaning, for once the words feel pretty easy to interpret. Not to remind myself either. I have it memorized by now, like I memorized so many of the other passages on the journey from Duran. I read it to find that deeper truth. I watch a sodden gray shirt float past in the waters, half-submerged, refuse of the society I grew up in. I feel a kinship with the monk who wrote this passage, whoever he was. So much of what I knew before I escaped the temple has turned out to be lies. And I've gotten a taste of those deeper truths, too. The secret abilities of hierarchists like Nerimes, the hidden unity of the male and female faiths I was taught were enemies, and the power that comes from uniting their magics. I reach out again, focusing my concentration, seeking a particular stream of blood inside. And if I could just dig deep enough, the passage reads, I might gain power over even the highest and mightiest among us. The meaning is clear. If I unlearn everything I'm supposed to, if I gain the muscles the author says he doesn't have, I should be more powerful even than my enemies and their hierarchism. I find the stream I'm looking for and push my awareness down it, across an ocean and through two bodies, seeking the blood I first tasted while battling for my life across the highest balcony of the Ujjayan temple. The blood of Nerimes. I find only blankness. Where in every other connection there is now a richness of sight. The constant stream of thoughts from water sight, the deeper current of feelings from blood sight, and the unity of these two in the intuitive knowing of the heart. This is the fullness of our unified sight, something I usually struggle to not get overwhelmed by. But with Nerimes, and I know this is him, know the tang of his blood, there is only blankness, like the slate gray ocean over the rail. I press harder, look deeper, pushing myself to grow stronger, to see the unity of all things. I squint against the backdrop of overcast sky. Nerimes' blood isn't blank exactly. I feel a texture there, like plaster spread on a wall, slightly rough and uneven. It's not the perfect absence of a bloodborne, but a man-made block put up against intrusion. a water blind, and a blood blind too, blocking all possible sight. I shove my awareness out, scrabbling for edges, try to sharpen my focus, and slice through. Nothing. I can break through water and blood blinds now when the person holding them loses concentration. This blind never slips. Hierarchism. It has to be. Even Narimes couldn't keep his concentration this perfect all the time. It feels as solid as his blind that first day he came to spar with me in the temple, when I was still caught between seeking a house and proving myself stronger than anyone else. I laugh, the sound lost in the chill breeze blowing off the headlands. I feel like that novice some days, still full of anger and suspicion, still too weak to do anything about it. I let go, panting, after another few seconds of trying to break through. The strength I'm seeking is different now, but I need it even more than I did back then. I need it to kill Narimes, to break through his blind and stop his heart, but that's not even the main reason. I need this strength to stop the floods, to control the monocle like the Chronicles talk about, and to stop my enemies if they try to trigger the floods early. I want to believe, even if Narimes or Miara or Yeolat has found the monocle, that they're not as close to uniting the ways as I am. That politics or craftology or whatever else they try is never going to give them as deep a unity as the one I'm seeking, as the kind Yemla told me we needed before he died. My heart clutches at the thought of him, slumped over the side of a boat in Sarante, Dale arrow through his neck. Another ally dead. And for what? Palm swells through one of my blood bonds, and I hear gentle steps behind me. Tewo. The peace I feel in him is a welcome antidote to my own churn. The waters are strange today, he says, gazing past me to the sea. I nod, spotting a broken chair bobbing in the water. There is something off about the ocean, but it takes me a moment to find it. Calm, I say, even though there's a breeze. We had to engage the ship's craftology to get close to shore or lose a whole day trying to tack against the breeze. Perhaps the mother is offering us a lesson, he says, still looking out. I see what he's getting at a second later, and am grateful that Tewo's not the kind of person to spell it out for me. That would be Deshaun, or maybe Anon. I sigh anyway, because I know he's right. I wish I could be calm. There's just so much riding on me to figure this out. On us figuring it out, he says, laying a hand on my shoulder. And anyway, it is not actually up to us. It is up to the other to guide us. We just have to stay in touch to notice when she does. I bite my lip rather than speak my doubts. At this point, the mother, or Uje, or whatever you want to call it, seems as likely to wash us all away as help us stop the floods. And so we must be drowned, 213 reads, for I was not strong enough to see through its reflections, and neither will be this world. If I'm to believe Ujeism, those words came from God. Thank you, Tewo, I say at last. I wish staying in touch felt as easy as it used to. It will, he says, so confident, so faithful, that I can't decide if he's deluded or I am. We should reach port in 15, Isong says, coming to the rail with one of the Dale's strange instruments in his hand. Have them slow the drive by half. Okay, I say, finding my connection with a sailor named Neshma and guiding him to manipulate the ship's controls. With unified sight, I can also catch Neshma's thoughts on the matter, wondering where we're going, what we're going to do with him when we get there. I send him reassuring thoughts. I've gotten to know all 10 Dale sailors on board, pushing them like this. Neshma's one of my favorites. The thrum weakens beneath us, though the ship glides on, its sleek lines cutting the water like no Saraean vessel could. Begdo clears his throat from behind me. If you don't mind, Alethea, I'll make my way to the river post once we're docked. I'm eager to hear how the temple received our delegation. I hold back a reminder that Estrigia has been getting updates through code all along. The delegations we sent back to the rebel temple and guildhouse were of mixed genders, on my insistence, so we've been able to stay in touch at the instant speed of blood code. Begdo's listened to the updates with more than a bit of mistrust. He's still an old monk at heart, even if he decided to follow me, which is one of the reasons I didn't want him in either delegation. The other reason is that, if we do end up going to Saray, he's exactly the kind of monk the Sarayan temple might listen to. I haven't given up hope that I can unite the monks and Therakins in Saray, too. According to Yemla, I need to unite as many people as I can. I'm about to ask Begdil to check the river post for news from the Sarayan temple, one place the sisters don't have access to, when Akifte calls from the crow's nest, where he's taken to spending long hours. Ahead! Do you people see that? I look back to the water, straining to see anything different. It's hard without much sunshine, but... Isong lets out a low whistle, just as I catch something too big to be regular trash floating in the waters ahead of us.
Is that an ox cart? Begdil asks.
How did it get out here? Too big, Isong says, leaning against the rail and straining his eyes. Alethea, have Neshma turn us 2 degrees port. Whatever it is, we don't want to hit it. I do, and let Estrija know we are getting close, carefully ignoring the sensations our blood connection brings. She and Anon have been spending a lot of time below decks this last week. She appears a minute later, along with a disheveled-looking Anon, smirking around a lit clove. They get to the rail just as the thing in the water rolls, like the whales that breach off the western coast, revealing a sloped edge covered in shingles. A house, I say, my chest tightening. Carts occasionally fall off seaside roads or off barges crossing the strait from Bamani. But houses? What in coffers, Anon says slowly, is a house doing out here? There's only one thing it can be, but before I can force the words out of my mouth, Akifte calls again.
More ahead, a whole river of them!
All eyes turn to the water, where I can just make out what he's talking about. A current of lumps spilling out from Jito Bay, too big to be refuse or ox carts. Each one tightens the strap of worry across my chest. One by one, my allies turn to me, varying degrees of distress and doubt in their eyes, wondering what this means. I, for once, don't have any doubt. I wish I did. I take a steadying breath. A flood, I say. It's the only thing that could do this.
Impossible, Begdil says,
shaking his head as we glide past the gutted house, clothes and chairs and beeswax candles drifting from its gaping doorway.
Could have been a landslide. Jito is built on a bay like Saray. They might have had heavy rains.
We would have seen the clouds, I answer, watching as we cut closer to the river of debris. The corpse of a pig floats next to the spreading ruin, skin only starting to discolor. We've stayed in sight of land. Any storm big enough to do this, and this recently, we would have seen. Anon blows smoke. Then what was it? There's only a slight tremble in his voice. Our enemies, I say quietly, turning back to the waves. Our enemies or our god. Those are the only options.
More importantly, at the moment, Isong says, practical and unshaken as ever, do we continue on or turn around?
On, I say, feeling the tightness in my chest settle into determination. The ship can handle it, and we need to see this.
All right, so I hope you enjoyed that. Hope you're excited to see what happens when they go into port. And now I just wanted to share with you a little bit of the lessons that I've learned in writing these four books. In a lot of ways, the Tidecaller Chronicles are a big learning time for me. I mean, I've been writing for 10 years, and I have a previous series that's also four books long that's out with a publisher, The Empire of Resonance. But the savvy readers or the angry readers at the end of book four have noted that that series doesn't really feel like it's done because it's not. Because I had planned a fifth book, but I just fell out of love with my world building and my characters in that series. And that was probably one of the biggest lessons I learned in then writing this series, starting with book one, is that I needed to take more care with the world to make sure that I cared about it, and especially the characters to make sure they were compelling. I've talked in other places about how Alethea kind of jumped off the page at me while I was planning a completely different book. And I knew that I had some connection and resonance to this character, and then I wanted to write her story, which is a very like woo thing for me to say, because I'm not much of a mystical writer. I'm more of a like workmanly, craftsmanshiply writer, but I felt a connection to the character, and she has totally drawn me through these four books, and I would be happy to write more, in fact. But this book does try to put a pretty little bow on everything that's come before, because I want to give, just like chapter breaks give you a natural place to breathe, if this series gets longer, I want to give you a natural place to feel like these four books have told a larger, complete story, and to get a sense of resolution instead of continually being drawn on like some TV series that always ends on a cliffhanger. I wanted to end with some resolution. So, spoiler warning, you end with quite a bit of resolution here. But all of that to say that if the lesson that I learned most from the previous series is that I need to care about my characters in order to keep going with the story, I think the lesson I didn't learn from that series is how to finish a series, because I never wrote the fifth, I still haven't written the fifth book. I do have good intentions of writing it someday, but I need a lot more fan feedback that says, please, please write this. And I think I'm maybe not getting it as strongly as I do get feedback from this series, because the characters aren't as compelling. The world is still cool. I think the plots are great, or whatever, they're good. It's hard to say that my own stuff is great, but the characters aren't pulling me back, and I don't know if they're pulling readers back. So that was a big lesson. But now in this one, I had to think about plot and world. How do I bring them to a pretty conclusion, as well as character? How do I finish their journeys? All of those things that I sort of just left unresolved in The Empire of Resonance because I didn't care enough to resolve them, and only later have regretted not giving the reader more closure, because it's not really fair to not finish a story that you've started. And that's why I wanted to finish this one at least somewhat, because I'm going to write other things for a while. I hope to come back to it, but I don't know, I might die. So in the meantime, let me give this series a resolution. So I learned a lot of lessons in writing this about how to bring things to a resolution. One of them, again, is that book one has to be the best that you can possibly write, because if you're still improving as a writer, book two is going to be better than book one, and book three will be better yet. And I feel like this book, book four, and a lot of the advanced readers have told me this, it is the best one of the series. But like I said in the spoiler warning, you can't read it by itself. So one of the lessons that I've learned in writing this and publishing it over the last 3 years and learning marketing and realizing that to market three, what I have to do is market book one, because nobody can read, you can't read book three by itself. So to have confidence and to like tell people you really need to read this and to push it, I need to believe in it, which means that if you're going to spend a lot of time anywhere, and hopefully you spend it everywhere, but especially on book one, you've got to polish it, and it's got to be like truly the best example of what you can do. And that is true for book one in this series, Daughter of Flood and Fury, but it's not true anymore. I think I could write a better book one than that. And so as I think about writing next book one, which I'm going to do in a couple weeks, I'm super excited about. One of the lessons that I bring from this series is that it's got to be so good. I need to spend my time writing it, planning it, polishing it, doing all the things, not being lazy in a way that it's possible to be with later books, because once people are invested, you can kind of just give them the story without all the luster and shine. And that's not a thing I want to do, but it is a thing authors can do. And it's an urge that I have to resist, because I'm not much of a polisher. I have my vision. I want to get it out. And usually after I've written the first draft or maybe the second, I'm like, there it is. There's a story I wanted to tell. But the little bit of extra work that I can put into like catching all the errors and beautifying the language and polishing up the prose makes such a difference to your final experience that, you know, I can't let myself skip it, even though my natural inclination is to like sort of hew the rough statue out of stone and then be done with it. Another thing that I've learned in this one, it's been really interesting, is that the best parts of this series have been the unplanned ones. When I wrote the first book, I wanted it to be a page-turning, quick read, but still feel epic. I was calling it epic, but YA at that time, and the series, I think, has not really turned out to be very YA, but I wanted it to read really quickly and yet to have that epic fantasy feeling of a big, immersive world. And how I ended up doing that was hinting at a lot of cool things and keeping them consistent in the first book, but not really getting into them, keeping the story really tight on a few characters and a few magics and a few mystery points, instead of like letting this thing sprawl out like someone like Steven Erikson might do. So I sort of gave myself all of these things to flesh out later, but hadn't really thought a lot of them through. I just knew that they were there and knew enough about them to not mess them up in book one. But as I wrote the subsequent books, and each one takes place in a different setting, and each one explores another magic, It was so much fun to make sure they all fit with what wrote before and find what new things I can put into this world that make sense. Brandon Sanderson has said that limitations are more interesting than powers in terms of a magic system. And I find that limitations are often very inspiring creatively, like a poem that you write in an established form, like a sonnet, for me is easier to write and pushes me in more directions than just blank prose that I can write in any way I want to. And in the same way, all of those little tips of the iceberg that I pointed to in book one became so much fun to dive down and fulfill because I already knew the bay and the harbor that they were in. And I knew what other icebergs they had been bumping up against in the world of the Tidecolor Chronicles, but there was a lot of space there for me to do other things. And fleshing out that world with limitations was really fun for me. And some of my favorite things, like the unity of magics that Alethea starts to explore in the previous book that get more intense here, and the old politics that come before the politics we're familiar with in book one, writing that history and then having it come out in the older characters, has been really fun. And also the villain's backstory. There's a couple villain backstories in this book that come out that were so fun. And I could only write them because I had already had those villains on the page and seen them act in a particular way. And then finally in this book had the space to say, but why are they acting in that way? What's their actual deep motivation? And that was super fun. So in terms of a lesson learned from that is that, again, along with book one needing to be the best, I also need to let myself scattershot and sort of trust the muse when they say, like, let's say this thing over here and not know what it is and just let it happen, because later on that's going to be one of the most fun things to do. Some of the series I have to plan up front, like what is the basic plot and where are my characters going to go and what things are going to be important for it to stick together at all. I kind of have to know that. But for these smaller things that may become important or more plot relevant enough books along that I haven't really plotted out what's going to happen. Like in this next series, book one is pretty tight, but I don't really know the details of book two or three beyond broad strokes. The things that I just kind of point to in book one then can be formative for the later books, but also be limited. And I don't know, I'm probably saying too much about it, but I found that process really cool as an author and really inspiring instead of just kind of being able to do whatever, like writing a bunch of book ones. Book one needs to be the best, but it's definitely not my favorite. It wasn't in previous series, isn't in this one. And I guess that's another thing that I have thought about in writing this book four is that everything feels so intense because I've had all this time to build up to it, and we have all these history with the characters, and we know so much about the world and the magic, and the stakes feel high because we've been talking about these stakes for four books and building up to them and trying to solve them and failing, and now finally we have to solve it somehow or the world's going to end, is usually what happens in epic fantasy. And I love writing a book that has that long history and those complex character relationships. And for me, in previous series and this one, that only developed over time. And I think all of the relationships felt pretty simple and the politics felt pretty simple in book one. And in reflecting on that, a series like Game of Thrones, which everyone loves for a reason, has that complex interaction from book one because he wrote such a rich backstory and history into it. So a lesson that I'm taking away from this one too is that to make book one the best it can be, I need to write book zero, which is like the previous 30 years, especially in deep detail. So when these characters come out on the page, they already have conflicts and loves and interests in each other. And the politics that drive the plot of book one are things that have been going on. They didn't just start like the day before chapter one opens. They have to feel real. And the more complex and the more that I'm coming into an established world instead of sort of like a just begun one, the more meaty and ultimately interesting, I think, book one is going to feel, even if we haven't spent any time with them beyond the first page of chapter one or whatever. So I'm spoiled in this one. You heard chapter one. I had so much to play off of that it just kind of referenced all these things that we already know. So anyway, I could probably go on and tell you a lot of other cool things that I learned in doing this, but I'll leave it there because I don't want to talk forever. And I'll just give you a preview. The next preview chapters that are coming out for chapter two, I'm going to talk a little after that about when your dead body is a dead city and how that worked. Chapter three is a little bit about what to do with characters that have grown old, who've gone through so much, chapter four is talking about the very weird point of view that I end up using in this and how I try to make it and hope that it works. And chapter five is all about fulfilling book one promises, because there were a lot, and that was the main task I felt I had to do in this book, is make good on those promises one way or another. So I hope you'll keep listening to the rest of the series, that in the meantime, this podcast finds you well and in the company of good books.
For more information on Levi Jacobs and his books, including the award-winning Tide Collar Chronicles, visit www.levijacobs.com. Or for a free audiobook, only available to podcast listeners, go to www.levijacobs.com/free. Thanks for listening, and read on.